Sorry for the delay. Fred Williams, I had a dream last night, and by the way, if you don't know me, please bear with me. I had a dream last night. I dreamt I was facing all of you in my maiden form bra. How did I ever get in this predicament? I think you can understand we've never really had anything about the pricing of records. And I must confess I did succumb to Tim Brooks' sweet talk. I'll swear he promised me a 14-inch Victor Deluxe of Jules Levy doing "You Don't Need Nothing for Your Nerves." I told Tim I must be 99% crazy, and he agreed that I was 1% sane. What do I know about the pricing of records? And then it came to me. Why suggest anything that I don't know, or I would like to do, or I don't do? Tell them what you do. I get my prices, excuse me, from customers, friends, and dealers. I'm sorry, I thought that sank in. I didn't mean it quite that way. However, boy, was I relieved when that dream returns to some semblance of sense. My story briefly, and I have asked the panel to follow a criteria, and I'm going to ask Tim, would you help me out, or anybody here, just pass these, whoops, sheets out so that you have a guide as to what we're doing. I had hoped to have a criteria sheet for you, but I've asked that each person say something for a couple of minutes about themselves and take 6 minutes to tackle the subject. I handle all kinds of records. I sell only by a mail fixed price. I'm a specialist in military band music. Actually, I got to like Sousa because I play the sousaphone. I became a dealer because I couldn't afford to buy the records anymore, and a great defense is a terrific offense. I'm a professional musician, and I spent a good deal of my life practicing music. In front of me you see a few books, and I'm going to just run down them quickly. There have not been an awful lot of price guides in past years. Of course, the eruption is in full swing, and probably the last 4 to 5 years have seen a tremendous production, and we've only seen the beginning. Will Roy Hearn's book is probably familiar to jazz buffs, having come out in 48 in this version. Whether you agree or not, this is not the place to cast an opinion. It's just what has happened. This is the book which some of you are familiar with. It's the part to the pricing guide, which does not have a cover anymore. You see it does get used. This is Julian Morton Moses' price guide to collectors' records, the acousticals of the U.S., the operatic end of it, and to some degree instrumental. Running through a few of these, is Hamilton here? Did Bob Hamilton come? He didn't get here. Bob Hamilton was supposed to be here. Here are a couple of the Osborne Hamilton books. This is the original one. This is the second edition, and I think there are three other books that have come along with it. You may have seen these. These are two of Probst's books, Golden Oldies. Those oldies but goodies. Peter Soderberg, who was supposed to be here, his second edition of old records. Basically, big band, but many other things. A very excellent book. Oops, I'm sorry. I retract that statement. Record, the American Premium Record Guide by Les, not Lester, Docs. And another book here, Collectible Rock Records by Randall C. Hill. At the end of my panel's comments, I would ask, and not till then, that Tim, where are you? Are you there, Tim? Tim's not here. Mike, do me a big favor. At the end, would you hand these out and make sure that people have them face down? I'm going to time a 1.5-minute quiz, which would be not based on this, but a lot of idiocy, called The Pricing of Records, in fact, Last Trades. And I think we'll have a little fun with it. Without any more nonsense, I'd like to start this off, and nobody knows who's first over here. And Tim, will you try it? Tim Fabrizio. He doesn't know what he's going to say, but neither does he.
Okay, you just want a basic modus operandi here, right?
You can wave your arms around.
Not too strong.
Right.
Males must be slow.
I did get that, but okay. All right. I'm a partner in the firm Musique, which deals through mail auctions in mostly pre-1914 sound recordings, cylinders and discs, and occasionally a few other little things thrown in, little gewgaws like roll Monica rolls and that sort of thing. We also deal in machines, talking machines, cylinders and discs, and as well parts, horns, that sort of thing. We're located in Canandaigua, New York. Insofar as the category of record that we deal in, that's not really the mitigating factor in our choice of inventory. It's really more a case of the time frame. So in other words, we could have classical, or we could have vocal, or we could have pop music, or marches, or whatever, as long as it falls within the period of time with which we are most accustomed to dealing. So that's basically from the 90s to the 20s. We really don't do much in the 20s. And occasionally we get something later. We recently had some radio transcriptions from the late 40s and 50s, and didn't do too well with them.
I guess it was the country.
It wasn't our, excuse me?
I'll buy the country stuff.
No. Oh, okay. We don't have it. Sorry. Okay.
I'll help you there.
So in other words, we're basically 78s and cylinders. And we do get into personality stuff and some political things like Roosevelt and, you know, Bryan and those people. We don't maintain a shop. Basically, it's a mail auction, and I should add that this mail auction is conducted on a sort of closed bid system, whereby, unlike a number of other organizations with whom I'm sure you are all very familiar, we do not disclose the bids during the auction, nor do we disclose them after the auction, nor do we accept telephone bids. And there are a variety of reasons for this. Some are logistical, insofar as our own time and ability to be properly involved with it are concerned. Others are philosophical reasons. But We will help anyone who's foundering and unable to hazard a proper bid. If we are, queried, we will be big enough to help someone out. But it's not our policy to disclose the current high bid and then, sort of top it. Something which we also do is that we do not generally have minimum bids. Now, minimum bids are, you know, a very frequent fixture in mail auctions, and we do not use them for the most part. Again, the reasons for this are manifold. We have some logistical and practical reasons, and we have some philosophical reasons, but occasionally we do throw in a minimum bid. Most of the time we don't use them. Okay, and the auction is typical. It's mailed out at a certain point, and at a certain point all bids must be returned, and you know, first person to get there with a tie is the winner, and all that sort of thing. Okay, my own personal background is, well, it's rather eclectic. I've been fooling around with this stuff for about 10 years, and most of that time, really, I guess I've been attracted to certain weird kinds of things like the Chicago machines, which caught my fancy, and I've spent a lot of time researching them and, you know, searching around for their records. I guess I would have to say that, like Fred, I started dealing in the records as well as looking for them on my own as a form of expediency. You know, they get expensive, and you end up with ones that you don't want, or doubles, or triples, or quadruples, or multiple copies, and you want to get rid of them. And it became a kind of expedient. Now, I should also add that I've also had a kind of a love affair with Free Enterprise for quite a while. You might have noticed my sort of adulation of Arthur J. O'Neill in my speech, if you heard it yesterday. I guess the reason for this is because I relate to him, owing to the fact that he was such a little schemer, and I've always been attracted to the, mercantile system. I have a bookshop, and I've done other things in the past, tried running a little restaurant and that sort of thing, and that aspect of it, that sort of you know, dealing with the public, has always intrigued me, although it can be difficult. Indeed, it can be. I guess those are my circumstances as to having become a dealer. My musical background is, well, once again, eclectic, but I guess somewhat predictable if you consider my age. I played in the obligatory rock band, Beatle-like rock band, in the 60s in high school. I then graduated to the 60s folk scene with my guitar and harmonica, and I continued along. Later, getting into the restoration of pianos, and to a certain extent, piano rolls, and I attended a school of fine arts in Boston, and studied theater and other realms of artistic expression. So I guess that has some music in it, and I like to sing. Although I'm not going to regale you with anything right now.
Tim, I'll have to stop you. Your eight minutes are up.
Okay, very good.
Unfortunately, we didn't get to the subject of pricing. I hope we will here. And I would ask next that Don Wetzel take up the cudgel and explain his situation. Gentlemen, if you would, address yourselves to the subject primarily, and to the best of your ability, quote examples on the prices of records. That would be most helpful.
You did ask me to mention some of my primary, my past activity with cassettes and all. Basically, I'm a record collector, who's learning to share the things I love. And it's for years, my mother claims I was two when I got vaccinated with the proverbial Victrola needle. And before I started grade school, I was absolutely obsessed with them. All the relatives and friends knew that Donnie liked records almost beyond belief, and gave me every time they cleaned house, they gave them to me. And I had an uncle in particular who was a very serious collector of vocal classical records, had a magnificent collection, and when he bought a stack of records at an auction, he would take out the vocals, except for the duplicates, which I did get, and give me all the rest. The result, of course, is just to say that I'm a very broad-based collector. I've listened to an awful lot of different kinds of things, and I've never really narrowed down that closely. I enjoy a lot of things in music. And most of my life, this has been a very introverted experience. The sort of thing that, not knowing other collectors, you invite your friends into the home and you corner them and bring them to your collection of phonographs and records and see how long you can hold their interest before they're trying to escape. And it was not the most fulfilling way to share a collection. And of course, when I got acquainted some 10 years ago with this organization, it was a great event to share, and almost beyond capacity, these late night hours in the hotel. And but in 1972, to get into how I became a dealer in selling recordings, I came where I worked. We had a facility for cassette duplication, which made the mechanical things possible. And I had one child in college. I was about to get the second one in college, followed the next year by having three in at the same time, and on a salaried Christian workers, a recording engineer for the Bible study hour salary, this didn't seem at all possible. And I said, why can't my hobby some way help this situation out? And so it was the combination of wanting to find ways to share what I loved, as well as a little economic necessity. Now, I wouldn't claim that this was accomplished, the education, which we paid all the bills somehow, just barely, all for old-time music, the name of my little home business. But my wife certainly went back to work and contributed as much as I did, so I have to give her credit for that and not take it all for myself. But we did, there's one aspect of mentioning this cassette business here which does not address the record pricing. That perhaps is the reason for mentioning it at all. And that in learning what the market was, I discovered a market that very few of us are addressing at all, and it's a big market out there. What I did was to place ads for things that I had in various kinds of magazines and publications. And there were a lot of them. I get almost nothing back but other magazines wanting me to advertise in their magazines. But there were some that worked. And this, in a sense, established what kind of content I had, because I was serving the market that responded. And I've forgotten most of the unsuccessful ones, but I was always a regular in Collector's News. But I never got volumes of results from Collector's News, enough to pay the ad and to build the mailing list a little bit. And because I like dealing with collectors, I'm a collector, I maintained this, not because it was greatly profitable or a volume reaction. But I tried all the Saturday Evening Posts and the High Fidelity and with minimum success. But the one thing that really worked was the very successful nostalgia magazine, Good Old Days. I did not run into many collectors through that. But I sure found a lot of people that loved the records that I had. They didn't want the one composition that they were looking for to fulfill their collection. They wanted to hear hours and hours of the music they loved and identified with. And a lot of high percentage of older people have naturally. And a real fulfilling outreach to people with problems in hospitals and in hard situations. And I find that all of these reissue products that we have in records and in any form that I know of is not aiming to those people, really. They're not satisfying that very great market. It's so much greater than just selling records to collectors. And just to bring this part to a close, when I was working under the assumption, as I created these hour-long things from my older records, that I was working in public domain, and when it found out that it was a much smudgier than that, and that there was question marks on it, I ceased at the when the new copyright law came in, not because that copyright law stopped it, it did make it more difficult, but I learned other things about mechanical copyrights, and I didn't want to be a part of anything that wasn't 100% clear. I think the way to handle that sort of thing, when there is a natural demand, is not to just do what you want to do, but to make sure that the demand is obvious, and that maybe someday there can be a way that these things that are not profitable to the large companies, there can be a media and a way of reaching people with this selective sort of material. Now, how I got into auctioning records, I've just run two auctions. I'm brand new at it, so I'm not settled in the way that I do it. I'm perhaps the only value in me mentioning being up here at this point is that I'm in the point of thinking it out, which just how it's done. I had my uncle's collection to sell. He died, and about 5 years after that, my aunt was ready to emotionally be prepared to dispose of it, and with Larry Holdridge's help, who sold some wonderful 1903 Columbia Grand Operas and McCormick's Tick Tock and other such things for three figures, got us started, and Larry also helped me to dispose of the 85% of the collection, which even when you collect every single record he owned was sold. We didn't just select the good ones, quote unquote. They were mostly good. But the average sale was over $3 a piece, even including all the, what some people might call the culls. So it was a nice collection, and it netted my aunt for about a collection of 2,500 records, well over $10,000 after the commissions were taken out. And I was able to use this as a means of finding out whether I wanted to do this. I found out I wanted to do it. And I've only run two auctions, and the records have come in so fast that were good to sell when people found out I was selling records that I now have enough for, I don't know how many, 3 or 4 or 5 years sitting waiting in line for the time that I have to put into it. Pricing, I wouldn't even get involved with establishing a price. You have to know as much as Larry Holdridge does about his specialty to even credibly, I think, suggest prices for these records. I put a low minimum bid, which covers the cost of my listing and going through all this work, and it's a lot of work to list these records, to sell them. A 50-cent minimum is what I usually do, unless a particular consignee won't put up with that and insists on a higher minimum fee for any of his records to be sold. I did that once this last time. And so it's been very surprising to some people to see what these records go for, because it's wide open to what it means to the individual prospective buyer. And I think we tend to get into a tradition from a narrow field of interest of what records are worth. And that's never a static, it's not a continuing situation. Every year, every month, the circumstances change to make something valuable to somebody, whether it's to fill a gap in their collection or because one kind of record is more popular now than it used to be. I think we need to keep our minds open as to what records are worth. Am I running out of time?
Thank you. You do.
Okay.
I'd like to introduce Bill Legere, who's our Canadian part of this group.
Thank you, Fred. My name is Bill Legere, as Fred just said, and my business is talent booking. Ever since my mother bore me, she was vaccinated also by a phonograph needle, but it didn't affect me, didn't affect me, didn't affect me, didn't affect me. I can remember liking music from a very early age. So anyway, I began collecting records when I was in my early teens. I still remember the very first record I bought. It was during the war years, and there weren't that many to choose from. But anyway, I bought records for 8 or 10 years, and at a slow pace because I didn't have much money. Economy wasn't great. I didn't have any education or a good job. And finally, as things progressed, fortunately, the Lord blessed on me a little bit of good fortune, and I was able to have a little spare dollars to buy more records. Well, then I start getting into older items. And consequently, when you go to the various sources, flea markets, secondhand stores, fortunately, if you got a miracle, you find an obsolete store stock still intact, or at least in part. And you buy a copy of a record, then you may see two copies there. So, hell, it's a good record, so I'll take the other copy, too. It's only 50 cents. And as Fred said, and the other gentleman here, you start to get a second copy and a third copy. Well, then you have to dispose of them. Well, this begins the buying and selling process. What I've done, of course, I've visited many other collectors. I've learned to get an idea of what pricing was, because pricing is very difficult, as this gentleman just said, to ascertain, because I have sold an album for $45 and sold five other copies for $8 a piece, which means, of course, that the average price of that record isn't $45. And I usually take price guides with a grain of salt for that very reason, because they'll print the highest price the record was ever sold for and try to generate high prices for records, when in fact they're not really worth this much. One person doesn't know the price and he's got all kinds of money and he'll say, oh hell, I'll give you $20 for that one. In fact, the record may be worth $4, generally. But it's good for generating business, but if, as a buyer, as a collector who doesn't know and has limited funds, it's difficult for him to overpay when he doesn't want to overpay. So anyway, how I generated my knowledge of pricing was to issue auctions by mail. This way, you have a preconceived idea of what a record you think is worth. And when by talking to other fellow collectors, and you have to find other collectors around to get an idea of what they've paid for and what his friend paid for a certain type of record of a certain period, this gives you a basis of thought. And from that point, I put out auctions by mail, so I simply take the highest bid. I operate generally the same as the fellow on my left here. And I let them set the prices, so I don't really have a problem there as saying, well, heck, this is what it's worth. But normally, if I was to have a record and I have visitors coming to my home, I too do not have a shop. I have a basement full, unfortunately, from wall to the ceiling, from floor to the ceiling. If someone wanted to buy a record, I would take an average value of what I would get on auction. If a record sold an auction for $12, well, I say, well, give me 10, or sold for three, give me $2.50. If the guy came to the house personally, because I don't have to be involved with all the paraphernalia of issuing an auction, which is extremely time-consuming. There's no question of that. And the hours of packing, particularly if you're in the 78 area, you really have to pack well. And if you're into the transcription area, you have to make odd-size cases and so forth, because you can't buy these things. In regards to pricing, but as a rule of thumb, I think we use Bob Fuller, who's supposed to be here, somehow got lost in traffic or whatever. He has a theory, and I do too, that we set a minimum bid for all 78s of $2.50, 45s minimum $2, perhaps $1.50. You have to have at least that to cover the cost of producing an auction. Similar to what Steve does, I use exactly the same thing. I have an $8 minimum bid on LPs, because you can go to a store. And I hit your turf, by the way. I go down to the U.S. looking for stuff, because primarily the amount of records issued, the majority of them were in the U.S. So I'll go down a couple of times a year on a run in the U.S., and my last trip, I hit a store in the state of Ohio. No, pardon me, it's Kentucky. And they had collector's items on sale that normally sold for $6.98 or $5.98 when they came out, $12. However, they were still mint monos and sealed generally. So I paid the $12. Well, I have to have $14 or $15 minimum now to break even on that record. I will put now a minimum bids occasionally. I don't as well make a practice of minimum bids. I feel it's a person will offer what they can afford to pay or what they have to pay to get a certain item. But on rare items that I know that are worth a certain fixed amount, I know because 10 were sold and all at the same general amount, I will put a minimum bid, and this is simply to discourage somebody bidding $4.87 on a record that's worth $90 to $95, to try and cut down the time of compiling all these bids. Then that's how generally I base my pricing system.
Well, thank you. And last we have, but certainly not least, probably the most, Steve Smolian.
Hardly most. Skip some of the how I got into this thing. My experiences are parallel the other members of the panel pretty closely, with the exception of one particular area. I'm quite tuned into the classical market and to the rock and roll market. They seem totally diverse, and yet they're the two kinds of music I prefer. So I run mail order auctions in everything except classical. I've also dropped jazz because I found I could not keep up with the intricacies of the jazz market due to the reissues in such obscure corners of the world as Japan and Sweden and the like. Can you hear me? I don't know whether. And I was simply unable to keep up with the reading that was required to know whether I was offering a record at a premium, which was in fact available commercially. I think we're all dealing with different markets when you're working with different categories of music, and the operative forces in each market is different. The 45 rock and roll collector who is paying a premium for a record which is currently available on a KTEL past greatest hits compilation or something of that nature is an object collector. I know I have one very close friend who is also a marvelous performing musician in a rock and roll band who loves to smell his 45s.
The same is true of them. Yeah. Cylinders.
Mm-hmm.
Or
the classical collector very often is interested not in a first edition of a record, but is interested in the best sounding edition of the record. That is, that which is pressed on the quietest material and is processed most cleanly with the least amount of distortion and perhaps restored due to more modern techniques than when the record originally came out. For that reason, for example, I prefer the Odyssey reissues of early Columbia MLs to the originals, which are also cut with a 1 mil groove, so I have to change styli for them because a half mil or stereo stylus will rattle around under some circumstances. And also the material is so much better that the plasticizer has evaporated from some of the cruder earlier LP material anyway, making it noisier. So the later LP sells at a premium when it goes out of print and may in fact exceed the price brought for an original. That's not true in a lot of other areas. I'm not getting into the dollars and cents so much as outlining the different forces which operate the different markets. The show and soundtrack market, the key thing in that, the premium, is for the more complete version. Jamaica, the show originally came in mono and stereo. The stereo version had the overture, the mono did not, and when it was reissued by Victor, they also left out in both the mono and stereo the overture. So it's only the first edition in stereo of that that is worth the substantial premium, even though there are closeout versions of the other later issues still available. I won't go into all categories describing the various, what I read as various forces, but I will say this. I do run mail order auctions, as I say, in everything except classical. The reason for that is that I collect that most assiduously, and I'm not tempted to sell my collection when I'm in a corner. But in dealing with rock, I run two auctions. I run a rock auction, and I run a country show and soundtrack and general vocalist auction, since those areas tend to move closely together. And the lines are hard to draw between a country artist very often and a pop artist. But I have had such bad experience in recent years with rock auctions, with people ordering records, my going through the billing process, and then them not paying. The last auction I ran, 30% of the bidders in the gross amount that was bid, and also probably in the number of people who bid, did not honor their bids. And so now I'm going only to a want list service for rock, and I'm wholesaling this stuff out presently to people who run premium booths at so-called flea markets. I've had it with rock collectors. Now, this question of describing my musical background, there is one interesting facet which bears on this. I have an interest in musicology. I've attended the University of Pennsylvania, and I've done talks to organizations like the Association for Retarded Sound Collections on what to do with a sound archive after you have one. I have a background in recording engineering as well, and I do sound restoration as part of the way I make my living. And I formerly did general engineering, which is how I got interested in rock. I've done quite a bit of publication, and I'm basically, as Tim, an individual entrepreneur. I enjoy that facet of the marketplace, but the pressures are considerable. I find, for example, publishing a list, my recent list, the one which is available outside, I mailed over 1,000. Now, I print the number of pages which let me get away with one first-class stamp in the United States. Since it's a dated list, you can't let them put the package behind the radiator in the post office. You simply must get it into the mail and to the customer or potential customer as quickly as you can. That seems fairly inexpensive. But when you send them overseas, and I have well over 100 overseas lists which go out, those go out at the airmail rate, and they're weighed in 1/2 ounces. So it costs 62 cents a list to mail out. So the postage bill on this last auction was about $300, and the printing bill was fairly close to that, plus my time in preparing and grading the records, typing the list, etc. And you're talking a substantial investment before you see a penny back. In addition, you have your money tied up in accumulating the records before you can even list enough to make an auction. You then have the period of the auction. You have the period when you have to do the billing and pay for somebody to do the billing, and the cost of the billing forms in multiple parts and so forth. You then wait for the response. You then wait for the checks to clear, because I do not ship to anybody until the check is cleared. I will ship more quickly with a money order. And you have a lapse of 4 to 5 to 6, 7 months sometimes before the money that you have put into a record turns into more money, hopefully, on the response from your list. I also sell roughly, depending on the list, maybe 40 to 50% of what is actually listed, because I do run an $8 minimum. And I do list a lot of things for which I get inquiries when someone says, I want Burl Ives records, so I list a whole bunch of Burl Ives records. Well, the guy's only looking for 2, and nobody else may want them out of those 1,000 people. So I've got another 15 records which haven't sold. But I still have the investment in the cost of listing them, which I estimated about $2 for every record sold, not counting the cost of the record. The cost of shelving is considerable. So what I'm getting to is that in pricing these records with a minimum bid, I then do not mark the very expensive records with a very expensive minimum bid in addition to that. I feel that once the minimum is met, I'm not out to set a record, I'm simply out to sell them. And leave it up to the marketplace to determine it past that point. I do tend to have dropped dealing in 45s through auctions at all, and to work with private collectors on them in bulk units. The cost of the record is insignificant compared to the cost of handling when running an auction. And since 45s do not bring that much in compared with what LPs do, I'd rather maximize from the list than deal with the smaller bids that the 45s would bring in. I don't know whether I have
Steve,
any time
you're right
left.
On the nose. You're right on the nose.
Okay.
I just, in listening, a random thought. People ask, and I'm a generalist, totally. There isn't any area that I don't handle, except military band. I'm avaricious and greedy and everything else about those. And they never get out of my hands. Sorry, Dave. Frequency. Who are the artists across the entire spectrum that John Q Public writes to me about? And I get an average of 6 letters a day, and that's since 1972, since I started. Number one is Presley, overwhelmingly, but he is declining rapidly. Number two is Crosby, steady. Number three is Jolson, very, very steady. I won't go beyond that. I'm just giving you a sampling. Jazz goes for the high, on average, goes for the highest prices. Following that, classical, mainly vocal, but boy, not exclusively. I get some fantastic prices that knowledgeable people offer me. I told you, I get my pricing, almost all of it, from others. And in fact, I will call a second party, and I will pay him, because that's only fair as a professional person. While we open this up to all the questions that are coming our way, I'm going to have this quiz handed out. Would you be good enough, absolutely not, to turn that over? Just keep the blank page on your lap. Don't cheat. It will be a minute and a half, but I'll start you on that. I will not ask for any scores, and it doesn't prove a thing. And you'll quarrel with it on top of it, even though it's factual. May we entertain questions at this point? Please stand up. The line forms over there.
I mean, or is that unfair use?
There are no questions. Well, oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
Well, I like to ask the dealers, when you send out an auction list, why don't you stipulate on the list that the bidder send in the money with his bids and then refund that portion which he does not win? Well, say he bids on 5 or 6 records for $80. That would be the amount that he would win. Well, say he wins half the bids. Well, then refund that portion which he does not win, and then you'll never be out any money. Stipulate on the auction list that the bidder send in the money with the bids.
Well, I can certainly answer that one in a hurry. The basic reason is, first of all, there's no guarantees he's going to win any records at all to start with. He may lose all his bids.
Well,
in that case, you simply return his check or whatever.
Yes.
But the one problem comes in, and Steve is aware of the same problem, is that my list is, and I think Steve's, is international. Therefore, you become involved with money exchanges from all the different currencies around the world.
Well, yeah,
and you continuously in the bank, so every time you have to refund part of the money, it's going to cost you $1.75 to get a foreign money order, plus the rate of exchange difference in Canada is 18%. It would be a problem.
Well, it's...
And as a bidder on auction, and I think I speak for some other people too, I'm reluctant to send in a check to an unknown party because he sends me an auction list with some tasty stuff on it.
Well... The person running the auction has to protect himself, too, you know.
Well, this is one way in which I'm protecting myself, is just not doing it, because I have to assume good faith on the part of everyone else, and I would feel terrible doing it any other way. There are two more facets to that. First of all, there's an enormous amount of paperwork in doing refunds even just in this country. The second thing is you then have your customer's money, which he can't then use for something else over that period of time, and very often... I send out a list just before tax refund time, for example. I send out a list so that it coincides with kids arriving in college because they have their book money and they have extra money, but if you hit them at the end of the semester, they usually have no money.
Well,
the time involved in running an auction, which in my case is usually about a month, leads that much lead time for them to work with. It's also that though I don't encourage it, sometimes the bidder will win a number of things and then write me back and say, I'll take everything but this, which I since picked up at a garage sale. But why should you penalize him for that?
Well, it's paperwork whether the bidder wins or not. It's still paperwork.
It also makes a lot of money.
And it's also foreign exchange. When you have to mail out refunds or not, you have to bother with foreign exchange whether the bidder wins or not. And this method, it would eliminate, you'd have less work for yourself. It would eliminate the deadbeats and the chiselers, and it would be less work for you because less people would be
less
people would be sending in bids this way, and you'd get the real bidders, not the chiselers.
In all practicality, you'd so squelch the business that it might not be profitable. Now, I have one man who was the highest bidder in my last auction that bought over $600 worth that I can't get a penny from, and I talk with other collector dealer friends, and he's ordered $500 to $1,000 worth from them, and nobody's got a penny from. And but I will not say to him, I will not accept your bids anymore, but I will do just what you suggested with him if he asks to bid again. I will not accept, even read his bids, unless I see money on the line that is cleared. But I wouldn't do that to anybody but somebody who has treated me that way.
Well, now, do all of you ask for payment after you send the merchandise?
No.
Oh.
Absolutely.
Well, a lot of dealers ask for payment after they send the merchandise.
Oh, no. Oh. No one gets a record until I get paid.
That happened.
We're not in the gift business.
Well, Don Cleary done that, but he's out. Don Cleary, a fellow who's now in Florida, used to do that, and he's out over $4,000.
So the only dealer I know that did that.
The name of the game is he's bust.
Fred, there's one other point. This is the magazine gold mine. I know Steve doesn't like to rock the record. You've never seen this. These are auction lists after auction list after auction list. This is a monthly. There are people that go through this thing when they get it in the mail and look at every single record that's listed. Over 50,000 records listed here. They may send out bids to 40 or 50 dealers. I know specifically people that do that. There's no way in the world you get anybody to tie up the money to send out checks to everybody that they send in bids to. No one would bid. In addition, I don't think I've ever bid in an auction. I rarely bid in an auction when there's only one or two records on the list that I want, unless I've got to get it. Because of the expensive postage and everything, I get a record for 75 cents or $2. I have to spend a buck and a half for postage. The record becomes twice as expensive as it would have been. So if there's maybe 10, 20 records that I want, I bid on them. I may only win 5 or 6 of them. Rarely have I ever been on an auction like that where I could have afforded to pay for every single record had I won every record. I've never run into that problem.
No.
I've won every record. I don't think anyone.
I've had customers have that unfortunate thing happen to them.
Let me make a comment about the...
I get these very apologetic letters, which state
didn't
just
really
that.
Think I was going to get them all.
Let me make a comment about the gold mine.
If that situation arises, I will accept a deposit. I will accept payment over a period of time. I will accept payment for a package if they only win one or two records and it's to be shipped overseas, and will hold the records aside until they have enough to warrant the cost of an overseas package and the... especially to Italy, which is a very... I don't know whether you're aware of this problem in Italy. I have one man who buys from there and has to get his record sent to him first-class airmail, registered mail, return receipt requested, because the Italian post office apparently is a thieves den.
That's true.
And this means that he is spending pretty close to what he's paying for the records just to ship them so that he has some receipt to prove they arrived.
I think I'd like to make a comment about what you have there. I think we all ought to know that every generation, the 12, 14, 9, 10, goes bananas, and it gets worse on the music. If you've got a child in your home, you know what it is. And of course, what Steve is showing you there is the phenomenon presently, the wild enthusiasm, the hell with the prices, the hell with the quantity that I sell, but just the youthful enthusiasm, which is great, that all of the stuff is put in there. Most of it probably won't be sold or be sold for very little. And I think we have to put that into perspective. And now, we think that, you know, this is the biggest business in the world. It may be big in numbers of people. I question whether it's big in dollars. It may be. But when I talk to people like Val Shively and say, listen, there's no way I can get up here. I just can't. I got to be using that store. I got to make a living. Hey, now, come on now. And when Bob Hamilton can't come up here now, and he's not a dealer, but he's involved with those wonderful books. I only say that in a certain sense of the word. In fact, I asked him, you know, you guys are making a gold pile out of these books. No way. They're into their 11th, but they've got printed, what, 6? No way they're making a gold pile out of those books. So I think you got to understand, believe me, there's very little money in this record business, and it takes a dedicated soul to do it. And of course, what Steve and all these people in the panel here are doing, they're real students. Real students. What they're not telling you about is that they are looking for frequency. They're looking through all kinds of other dealers' lists to see if it's on there, what price is brought, if they can obtain it from somebody else. If you take the classical scene, you've got Larry Holdrege. I mean, you got fantastic prices. He's probably number one next to Discor down in Argentina. Maybe they're both the same. Some of you people know. And there are lesser lights. But you cut that down to be practical about it. You have to. This is a lot of study. I told somebody in here, Dave, last night, I have over 2,000 personally discographies just to refer to be able to grab some information. And another thing I'd like to say, and this is my final comment, in this list here, the guy who writes in, and I can't satisfy him, or the guy who's a little bit newsy, but he seems to be legit, and boy, a lot of this you got to figure out, this guy, all right. I do bend over backwards to educate him, and I do send the names of other dealers to him, but wherever they are, that I know about them. And I think that's the only fair way to do it. And of course, I found naturally that comes back to you in good vibrations. And I can say that vast bunch of people do that. Now, would you do me a favor? I'm going to ask you, are there any of those copies left over, incidentally?
Yeah, there's some back here.
May I have some here for the panel, because they do not know about this. And please don't turn it over. Don't turn it over. See, it's turned over back there. Put that flat.
Thank you very much. Fred, I just wanted to say that make a sort of an enlargement on your comment about being a student. I don't necessarily maintain an enormous collection of things on my own. I really don't. But if I'm able to let some of this stuff pass through my hands, I'm able to record it and add it to my own wealth of knowledge. And so in that sense, the money doesn't really become the most important thing. You know, if you're not able to have 80,000 records, then you can at least know about them and photograph them or listen to them. And if they're gone, then you have them inside of you. So
Tim's,
I agree.
Tim's bringing the heart out, and that's what it is. It's heart. Now, let's take 1 minute and 30 seconds. Ready, set, go. Don't turn it over. Don't turn it over, please. It's not 2 minutes yet.
Do I get a price?
The whole thing is these 20 items on the first page.
That's it. Don't turn the page. It's not fair. We all want to hear you gasp together when we get done with this.
And there's a Spike Jonze record that has a comment about turning the page.
It's called page 9. He called it Pagliacci. He said, that's page 9. Paganini.
1 minute and 90 seconds.
1 minute and 90 seconds.
You're musicians, you don't keep time.
No, he's doing all right.
And are we ready to stop? Okay, turn it over and have fun.
Huh?
How do you know these prices are for real?
I have authenticated all but one directly with the source. And that other one, the 20th, I have indirectly on what I call a non-controversial, he's totally authoritative.
It did, holy, I didn't realize. I was wondering why the guy was looking for that.
Yeah.
Now, in 5 minutes, over in that corner over there, we'll entertain the stories in regard to these records that you have. So we'll have a large meeting over there after we're finished. Excuse me, I'm kidding. Don't raise any questions about these, please. It's all in fun, but they're absolutely accurate.
Could I say one little quickie about how profitable this business is? My wife asked me, do you make a dollar an hour for all the hours you put in on this? And I said, gee, I don't think so, but I'm sure having a good time and I'm learning a lot.
I thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you very much. That concludes our 14th annual convention. I remind you that outside the door is a table where, if you would like to sign up for cassettes of any or all of the sessions this time, any you may have missed, you can do that. Also, at 1 o'clock this afternoon in room 156, which is off the foyer just to the right, will be the collector's swap. Also through that same door to the right is a room with samples of many publications, free samples for you if you'd like. Thank you very much. I hope you had an enjoyable meeting.
Did indeed. Thank you, sir.